Welcome to the deep dive. We often think of patents as, well, you know, like owning something outright,
Right.
like a house or some land. But what if there's more to the story?
Yeah.
Like, what if seeing patents as kind of like a public franchise helps us really grasp how innovation happens? That's exactly what we're diving into today, especially for those of you who are, you know, really into the whole world of new ideas and tech.
Exactly. We're going to be exploring what patent rights actually mean, their purpose, and all the legal stuff that surrounds them.
And we've got a ton of legal documents and analysis to guide us.
A lot of great stuff, yeah.
So by the end of this deep dive, you'll have a much clearer picture of like what a patent really is, where it fits in legally, economically, and all those kind of built-in tensions, you know, in the whole system.
Yeah.
We'll be using everything from court decisions to like specific laws and even expert opinions from legal scholars. So, okay, let's jump right into this public franchise thing. What does that even mean when we talk about patents?
It's a really important way to think about like the limits and the goals of patent rights.
Okay.
And initially, you might think patents are just like private property.
Right, right.
You see cases like American Bell Telephone Co., McCormick Harvesting Machine Co., Brown v. Duchan. They use language that makes it seem that way.
Yeah.
Like talking about a patent being the property of the patentee, stuff like that.
Yeah. So like private property, we all kind of know what that means.
Right.
But then we see this contrasting idea
of
a patent as a public franchise in, you know, cases like Pfaff, Seymour. So what's the real difference between those two ideas?
The main difference is that a public franchise gives you certain benefits.
Okay.
But it's ultimately granted by, you know, the public, like through the government and the law.
Okay.
So the rights you get aren't like absolute or just there naturally. Mm. They're very specifically laid out in the laws that created them. Cases like Gaylor, Wheaton v. Peters, and especially Brown v. Duchesne, they really stress this. Brown even says that patent rights come all together from the laws, and they can't go further than those laws allow.
So it's not like owning land where your rights are like more fundamental.
Right.
It's more like a license with really specific rules.
Exactly. A good example is Inter Partes Review, which was central to the Quozo case.
Yeah.
It's like a second look at a patent after it's been granted to make sure it was valid in the first place. And this process and the law itself, you know, 35 U.S.C., Section 261 states that patent rights are, quote, subject to the provisions of this title.
Okay.
eBay Inc. v. Merck Exchange highlighted that. So they're really governed by the Patent Act.
Right. So patents were like totally private property.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have these systems for like reviewing and maybe even canceling them. You mentioned older cases, though, like McCormick Harvesting and American Bell. They seem to give courts the power to like overturn patents, which seems kind of, well, contradictory. What about that?
The context is key. Those older cases, they were under the 1870 Patent Act.
Okay.
Which didn't have any post-grant review like we have today.
Right.
So those decisions were just reflecting the law back then.
Okay.
They don't tell us whether Congress, like constitutionally, could make a different system later on.
Gotcha. So the public franchise thing is really tied to the legal basis of patents.
Yes.
So where does the authority for patents even come from?
It comes from the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, the Patent Clause.
Okay.
It gives Congress the power to, well, quote, promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
And Graham v. John Deere Co. really highlights the balance here. It's about encouraging innovation, but also preventing monopolies that might actually hinder progress.
So like a built-in balancing act in the Constitution itself. Encourage invention, but, you know, don't lock things down so tight that nothing new can happen.
Exactly.
How has this this balance been reflected in patent law over time?
From the get-go, patent laws have had to walk this line.
Okay.
The first Patent Act, back in 1790, only allowed for 14 years for inventions that were not before known or used and were sufficiently useful and important.
Oh, wow. That's way shorter than the 20 years we have now. What was the idea behind that?
Right. And it also required inventors to disclose their inventions.
Okay.
Give a detailed description, maybe a model, to the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
The point was that this description had to be good enough that someone skilled in that area could actually make or use the invention.
Okay.
The goal was that after the 14 years, everyone would benefit from that knowledge.
Right.
It would be freely available.
So from the very beginning, it was like a trade.
Mm-hmm.
Limited time for the inventor in exchange for public benefit later on.
Absolutely. It's fascinating to think about what Thomas Jefferson thought about this.
Okay.
He was the first Secretary of State, really important in shaping that early system. Mm-hmm. He believed that giving exclusive rights on something already known was like changing the rules after the fact.
Okay.
And he was really concerned about patents blocking existing public knowledge.
Interesting. That shows the tension between rewarding the inventor but also protecting shared knowledge for everyone.
Yeah.
How do those ideas connect to the laws we have today?
They're fundamental. Our current patent law, like 35 U.S.C. Section 101, still outlines what can be patented.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the requirements for novelty in 35 U.S.C. Section 102,
okay.
meaning it has to be new.
Right.
And non-obviousness in 35 U.S.C. Section 103,
mm-hmm.
meaning it can't be a super obvious step from what's already known.
Right.
These stop patents from being granted on things that are like common knowledge.
So these are kind of like safeguards against blocking the public knowledge that Jefferson was worried about.
Exactly. It all comes back to that bargain, which you see in cases like United States v. Dooley or Condenser Corp.
Okay.
The inventor gets a limited time, usually 20 years now,
yeah.
in exchange for making their invention public. They benefit for a while.
Okay.
And then it becomes free for everyone to use.
It's all about balance.
Yes.
Let's talk about how patents actually work in the world of innovation and the economy.
This is where it gets interesting. Patents can actually help markets work better.
Really?
Think about a product like an iPhone.
Okay.
Which has parts from a bunch of different companies.
Right.
Patents on those parts let companies specialize and then trade or license their tech.
Okay, yeah.
So innovation can be more collaborative.
It makes sense. If every company had to invent every single part of a product, well, things would move way slower, right?
But there's a catch. For patents to help,
their
boundaries need to be clear.
Mm.
If it's too hard to figure out what a patent actually covers,
the
market can't value those rights properly.
Yeah.
And that can mess up trading and licensing.
Okay.
Plus, patent rights can overlap.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in complex fields.
Okay.
This is where you get what's called an anti-commons. It's where you have so many patents and so much uncertainty that it becomes super expensive and complicated to get licenses and actually make new products.
Right.
The book Patent Failure by Bessin and Mirror talks about this.
So patents can help, but if there's too much confusion, they can actually slow things down.
Exactly.
It's all about balance again.
It is. But patents also have what's called signaling functions.
Okay.
When someone gets a patent, the details become public.
Right.
And this sends signals to, well, companies who might want to use it.
Okay.
Other inventors, people with related tech, investors.
Oh, wow.
This actually explains why even industries where being first to market is really important still get patents.
If they're already first, why bother?
Because the patent document itself is like an announcement.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it easier to attract collaborators, find researchers.
Okay.
And the patents in a certain area show what's been done and what challenges are left.
So it's not just about keeping others away. It's about like putting your invention out there and finding opportunities. Right.
Okay. Let's get into some more technical stuff. Like how courts interpret patents.
Yeah.
Claim construction and what can even be patented.
Mm-hmm.
These seem like areas where there's a lot of legal back and forth.
Definitely. Claim construction is where courts decide what the claims in a patent actually mean.
Okay.
The claims are the numbered parts that define what the inventor thinks they've invented.
Okay.
Historically, some courts, like in Texas Digital Systems v. Telegenics, focused a lot on the dictionary definitions of the words.
So they'd literally look up words in a dictionary to understand the patent.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
They argued that dictionaries were the best way to understand how experts in that field would interpret the words.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you had to look at the whole patent
to
see which dictionary definition fit how the inventor used the word.
Right, right.
But things have changed. Now it's more about how someone skilled in the art would understand the words, like someone with average knowledge in that field. So you look at the whole patent document.
Mm-hmm. The detailed description, the back and forth with the patent office.
So technical terms can mean something specific in a field.
Right.
That might not be in a dictionary.
Exactly.
What about the rule that patent claims have to be super clear?
That's in Section 112, Paragraph 2 of the Patent Act.
Okay.
It says the claims have to clearly point out and distinctly describe the invention.
Mm-hmm.
The Nautilus v. Biosig case was about this.
Okay.
Some thought a claim should be invalid if it's not perfectly clear.
Right.
Others said it just needs to give a reasonable understanding to experts.
Okay.
It's about finding that balance.
You mentioned the Markman case earlier. What's so important about it?
Markman was a huge Supreme Court case that changed how we interpret patent claims and lawsuits. They decided that the judge, not a jury, should decide what claims mean.
So the judge has the final say.
Yes. Now let's talk about patent eligibility under 35 U.S.C. Section 101.
Okay.
This is where it gets tricky. The law says what can be patented, but courts have made exceptions.
Mm.
You can't patent laws of nature, natural phenomena, or abstract ideas.
Mm-hmm.
These are seen as, like, the basics of science and tech.
Right.
And should be free for everyone to use. Cases like Mayo Collaborative Services v. Prometheus Laboratories, Gottschalk v. Benson, and Alice Corp v. CLS Bank International are super important for understanding this.
Laws of nature, natural phenomena, abstract ideas, those are pretty broad. Where's the line between those and something you can patent?
That's the question. And courts have been debating it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Diamond v. Chakrabarty and Funk Brothers Seed Coat v. Calo Inoculant Coat are good examples.
Okay.
In Chakrabarty, a genetically modified bacterium was patentable.
Okay.
It was something created by humans,
yeah,
different from anything in nature.
Right.
But in Funk Brothers, a mix of natural bacteria wasn't patentable.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't changed the bacteria. It was just a natural thing.
Okay.
Patents reward new creations, not just discoveries.
Right.
The Myriad case with the BRCA genes showed this too. Isolating the genes wasn't considered an invention. The focus was on the genes themselves, which were natural.
So it's about whether you've actually created something new. This has been tricky for diagnostic methods, right? Where you're looking at natural things in the body.
Absolutely. The Mayo case highlighted that. It was about a method to find the right drug dosage based on blood levels.
Going.
They said it wasn't patentable because it was just a natural law.
Mm-hmm.
And the steps to measure those levels were routine.
But haven't there been cases where a new way of using an existing drug was patentable?
Yeah. And the Federal Circuit has been trying to clarify this.
Okay.
Like in Vanda Pharmaceuticals v. Westward Pharmaceuticals and Natural Alternatives v. Creative Compounds.
Mm-hmm.
In Vanda, the patent was for a specific way to use a drug for schizophrenia.
Okay.
It involved adjusting the dosage based on genetics.
Mm-hmm.
The Federal Circuit said it was patentable because it wasn't just the natural relationship between the droid and the body.
Yeah.
It was a new method of using that knowledge for a better treatment.
So it's the specific how that matters. Right.
What about abstract ideas in using computers?
Alice Corp v. CLS Bank International is the key case for that.
Correct.
There's a two-step test. First, is it an abstract idea?
Okay.
Second, does it have an inventive concept?
Mm-hmm.
Just using a computer to do something abstract isn't usually enough. Like an electric power group v. Alstom, where just doing better math on a computer wasn't inventive.
And then there's the Sequinom case.
Yeah.
Why is that one so important?
Sequinom is a great example of the challenges here. It was a new prenatal test that used fetal DNA from the mother's blood.
Okay.
Really groundbreaking. But the Federal Circuit said it wasn't patentable.
Why not?
Because it was based on a natural phenomenon,
wow,
the fetal DNA.
Okay.
And the steps to analyze it were seen as routine. It shows the struggle between rewarding innovation and sticking to the rule that natural things aren't patentable.
Even if using it as a breakthrough.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to some other requirements. Utility, enablement, and written description.
These ensure that patents are actually about invention.
And that there's enough info for the public later on.
Right.
Utility in 35 U.S.C. Section 101 means the invention must be specifically and substantially useful.
Okay.
Needs a real benefit, not just something maybe useful for research later, like Brenner v. Manson and Ettore Fisher said. You can't just say, maybe someone will find a use for this.
Right.
Enablement in 35 U.S.C. Section 112, paragraph 1, means the patent has to teach someone skilled in that field how to make and use the invention without too much experimentation.
Mm.
Cases like Henry Wands, Boston University v. Everlight, and Enzo Biochem v. Calgene show this.
Makes sense. It's about letting others use it later on.
Yeah. And written description, also in section 112, paragraph 1,
okay,
is about showing the inventor actually had the idea when they filed the patent. It has to describe the invention itself, like Ariad Pharmaceuticals v. Eli Lilly said.
So enablement is about the how. And written description is about showing you actually had the idea. Now, what about all the stuff that was known before the invention, prior art?
Right, anticipation in 35 U.S.C. section 102 means if something already exists that shows every part of your invention,
yeah,
then your patent is invalid. Like EMI Group v. Cypress and Vertigal Bros, v. Union Oil Show.
Yeah.
Inherency is when a detail of your invention isn't specifically said in the prior art, but it's just there because of how the prior art is, like in Henry Schreiber.
So if someone already did it, you can't patent it. What counts as prior art?
It could be a lot of things. Another patent, an article, even a publicly used device. A printed publication, like in Henry Cronin, Henry Hall, and Henry Liu, has to be publicly accessible.
Okay.
And there's the on-sale bar, where you can't patent something if it was sold or publicly used more than a year before you filed your patent.
Mm-hmm.
Like Helsin Healthcare v. Teva Pharmaceuticals talked about,
ever.
Prior knowledge by others, if it was public, also counts. Cases like Corella v. Starlight Archery, Coffin v. Ogden, and Gaylor v. Wilder show this.
Wow.
And if someone else invented it first but didn't patent it, you can't patent it either. That's in Section 102G. Cases like Dow Chemical v. Atlantic Richfield, Heard v. Burton, and Sylvester v. Grant show this.
So a lot of things could mean you can't get a patent.
Right. And even if your invention is new,
yeah,
it can't be too obvious based on what was already known.
Right.
That's obviousness in 35 U.S.C. Section 103.
Okay.
The Graham v. John Deere case laid out how to analyze it. You look at what was already known, the differences, and the skill level in that field.
Okay.
Courts also look at secondary considerations like, did the invention sell well?
Mm.
Did it solve a problem? Did it have unexpected results?
Interesting.
So was it more than just the next logical step?
It can't just be obvious to try.
Right. The Federal Circuit used to use a teaching, suggestion, or motivation test.
Mm.
But the Supreme Court in KSR International v. Teleflex rejected that. They said if there were only a few obvious solutions, it could be obvious even without a specific suggestion in the prior art. The Federal Circuit has been applying this in cases like Henry Kubin. There are also specific ways to look at obviousness in different fields.
Okay.
Like the lead compound analysis in chemistry. Daiichi Sankyo v. Matrix Labs and Otsuka Pharmaceutical v. Sandoz talk about that.
So many factors.
Right. And those secondary considerations can still be really important. Like in Transocean Offshore v. Maersk Drilling, unexpected results helped show the invention wasn't obvious.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about what happens when someone uses a patented invention without permission.
Yeah.
What can the patent owner do?
This is enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
One option is the International Trade Commission, the ITC.
Okay.
It's especially helpful with companies importing stuff.
Right.
The ITC is faster than regular courts.
Okay.
But it can only stop imports. It can't give money damages.
Gotcha.
And there has to be a related industry in the U.S.
So it's quicker but limited.
Right. In regular courts, you can sue for infringement.
Okay.
One important thing is the doctrine of equivalent. It's like in Warner Jenkinson v. Hilton Davis and Graver Tank v. Lind their products.
Mm-hmm.
It means even if the copy isn't exactly the same, if the differences are small, it's still infringement.
Okay.
But there's a limit. Prosecution history estoppel from Festo Corp v. Shuketsu Kinzoku.
What's that?
If the patent owner narrowed their claims during the application, they can't later say it covers more.
Makes sense.
What about means plus function claims?
What are those?
That's when you define a part of your invention by what it does, not just what it looks like.
Okay.
Like saying means for doing X.
Mm.
The claim covers anything that does that, even if it's built differently.
Okay.
But if you don't use the word means, it probably doesn't apply. Cases like Williamson v. Citrix and Watts v. XL Systems talk about this.
Right.
You can also infringe a patent indirectly.
How?
Like by inducing someone else to infringe.
Okay.
That's Section 271 BSC. Global Tech Appliances v. SEB is a key case. You have to prove they knew they were causing infringement. Sometimes willful blindness can be used to show they knew.
Interesting.
And there's contributory infringement, Section 271C.
Okay.
That's when you sell a part specifically for infringing, knowing it'll be used that way.
Okay.
And that part doesn't have many other uses.
Yeah.
There are also laws about supplying parts to be assembled overseas, Section 271F, and importing things made using a patented process, Section 271G. Cases like Life Technologies v. Promega and Bayer v. Housey Pharmaceuticals interpret those.
So many ways to infringe. What about defenses against infringement?
There are a few. One is inequitable conduct.
What's that?
That's when the patent applicant lied or hid info from the patent office. Theracense v. Becton Dickinson talks about that.
Okay.
You have to prove they wouldn't have gotten the patent without the lie.
Right.
There's patent exhaustion or the first sale doctrine. Like in Quanta Computer v. LG Electronics and United States v. Univis Lens.
Okay.
It means once you sell something covered by your patent, you can't control what the buyer does with it. There's patent misuse, like in Prinko v. ITC, where you used your patent in an anti-competitive way.
Wow.
Latches is when you waited too long to sue, which hurt the other side, like in SEA Hygiene v. First Quality. And finally, there's the experimental use defense, like in Mady v. Duke University.
Mm-hmm.
It's really narrow, basically for pure research, not commercial stuff.
Gotcha.
Different from doing research for FDA approval, which is protected under Section 271D8, Neonatory B1. Merck v. Integral Life Sciences is an example of that.
So many ways to defend against infringement. What happens if you win an infringement case? What can you get?
Usually you get money damages under 35 U.S.C. Section 284.
Okay.
Sometimes it's based on your lost profits, like Panduit v. Allstate's Plastic and Wright Height v. Kelly talk about. Mm-hmm. If you can't prove lost profits, you get a reasonable royalty. Georgia-Pacific v. U.S. Plywood and Microsoft v. Lucent are key cases for that. Sometimes you get triple damages if the infringement was really bad. There are also permanent injunctions where the court tells them to stop infringing, but the court doesn't always give those. eBay v. Merck Exchange and Broadcom v. Qualcomm talk about that.
Okay.
For design patents, you often get the infringer's profit, like in Samsung v. Apple. And sometimes you can get your lawyer fees paid if it's an exceptional case under 35 U.S.C., Section 285, and Octane Fitness v. Icon.
Wow, that's a lot. So what's the most important thing for our listeners to remember about all this?
That patents aren't just like owning a house.
Right.
They're more like a system to encourage innovation
with
a limited time and specific rules set by law.
It's not just simple ownership. We've seen all the complexities.
Yeah.
What can be patented, how to make sure it's valid, how to enforce it, how to defend against it.
And this brings us to a final thought.
Okay.
Think about how this public franchise idea affects debates about patent reform, access to tech, the future of innovation.
Right.
Think about industries where this tension between exclusivity and public benefit is really strong, like drug prices, software algorithms, green tech.
That's a lot to think about. And if anything we talked about today made you curious, we encourage you to look up the cases and laws we mentioned.
Definitely.
There's a lot more to learn. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Thanks for having me.